Hey there, I'm glad you could make it. Welcome to Logic in the Bible, where we take a logical and pragmatic approach to understanding the Bible, in addition to discussing different forms of spirituality, religion, and faith practices. This is the season premiere of Logic in the Bible Season 2. If this is your first time with us and you're not familiar with the podcast, Season 2 has been a very long time in the making. Our regular listeners have been very vocal about how long this has taken, and I apologize to all of you for the delay, and thank you so much for your patience. I've been working through some health issues, but be that as it may, I'm very happy and excited to have finally gotten here to this moment. Thank you for being able to share it with me. In today's episode, we're going to discuss the Bible and what it has to say about intimacy, sex, and sexuality with Reverend Dr. Deborah Hafner. So stay tuned, and don't forget to hit the like, subscribe, and follow buttons to make sure that you can stay current with each new episode. I'm Father Mike Cantor. I'm an apostolically ordained priest, a Bible scholar, and a theologian. And more often than not, I have a very different perspective on the topics that we discuss. First, a brief note. If this is your first time joining us and you're not familiar with the podcast, I would highly encourage that you listen to Season 1. In Season 1, I set the foundation for our conversations together. And I would also advise listening to the episodes in order because each episode builds on the previous conversation, and they all provide an enormous amount of context for our discussions. Keep listening today all the way through to the end, and in the wrap-up, I'm going to make it super easy for you to find Season 1, so you can get caught up, and don't worry, you're not going to be lost or clueless if you're just starting out with us on YouTube. But I may, from time to time, reference something that was probably talked about last season. If you're already listening to the podcast on your favorite player, rest assured, I will continue to upload Season 2 in audio form. But please visit the YouTube channel because there's going to be additional and exclusive content that you will not want to miss. All right, so let's get to why you all came. The topic of intimacy and sex as it pertains to the Bible is a bit, probably, I don't know, touchy for some. And some of you might be asking why I would start with this right off the bat. Well, for me, the answer is pretty simple. I observe that, especially here in the United States, but also in many places around the world, that the Bible has been used for a long time as a politicized tool to suppress, among other things, our God-given human sexuality. I think it's helpful to really outline and understand contextually what the Bible is actually saying on the matter. In an age of what I see as growing intolerance, faith, religion, and yes, even the Bible are being used to justify political platforms and ideologies, which I firmly believe are toxic, harmful, and often downright hateful, not to mention incredibly misinformed. There needs to be more of a discussion about what the Bible really says in relationship to these topics. And to do this, many of us are going to need to move beyond a lot of what we may have been taught, and in some cases may have heard from other people, to find out what is really the truth. A while back, I had the pleasure to and the opportunity to sit down and record a conversation with Reverend Dr. Deborah Hafner. She's a sexologist who's also an ordained Unitarian Universalist minister and has been for 18 years. She was the executive director of two national not-for-profit organizations and is the author or co-author of 7 books, including From Diapers to Dating, A Parent's Guide to Raising Sexually Healthy Children, which has been translated in 12 different languages. She holds a doctorate from the Pacific School of Religion, a Master's of Divinity from the Union Theological Seminary, a Master's in Public Health from the Yale School of Medicine, and a BA from Wesleyan University. Her work has been honored and recognized by organizations such as Planned Parenthood Federation of America, Union Theological Seminary, and the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality. I really do hope you enjoy our conversation. And remember, stay to the end for the wrap-up, and let's get started.
So you received your Master's of Public Health from the Yale School of Medicine. What sparked your interest in public health and the study of human sexuality, sexual ethics and justice in general?
In a sentence, in 30 seconds. I grew up actually in a home where parents talked about sexuality.
Oh, wow.
And my house was the place where you came to with your questions. So I'm grateful to my parents for that. I was actually thought that I was going to be a lawyer and then hoped to become a politician. And then I took a 1-week course on human sexuality, and it was indeed my road to Damascus experience. I realized that the world really did not grow up the way I did, and that people needed information and education to make healthy, responsible choices and celebrate their sexuality as a wonderful part of life. And so at the time, which was in the mid to late 70s, there were no PhD programs in human sexuality. There are now, for right. people who are listening. But at that time, there wasn't. So a public health degree was as close as I could come. And that led to my first act in my career, which was first working for the government and then for Planned Parenthood, and then ultimately as executive director of the Sex Information and Education Council.
Oh, wow. And you wrote the Planned Parenthood's first educator's handbook. Is that correct?
A long time ago, I was the director of education for Planned Parenthood of Metropolitan Washington. And at that time, what people used to do, Planned Parenthood educators, was to go into a school and give a 1-hour talk on birth control. And what I realized was the only thing anyone remembered was that a nice lady came and talked about birth control from a place called Planned Parenthood.
Right.
Which wasn't bad, but I want my educators to actually look at doing sexuality education and encouraging people to give people more than these are birth control pills, this is a condom kind of talk. So yeah, I did do that in the early 80s.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing. So you're doing human sexuality, and then you decided to become a minister on a whim, or what?
Right. So you know, as a pastor, no, we don't do this.
No, not.
So I experienced a call, which was kind of interesting as a Jewish Unitarian Universalist. There was nothing in my background that talked about God speaking directly right. to you, unless you go back right to the Talmud, but not to compare myself to Moses. But I did have a call. I felt a very strong voice presence saying to me, you are supposed to bring these areas of work together. And I spent 9 years resisting that call. I finally did a fellowship during a sabbatical at the Yale Divinity School, and the call got louder. And so finally, God's yes became louder than my no. And the second act of my career was working on bringing sexuality and religion together to provide a progressive religious voice on sexuality issues, but to also prepare clergy from all denominations to handle the sexuality needs of their congregants.
And you wrote A Time to Build Creating Sexually Healthy Faith Communities. Did that come out of that work, or how did that come about?
Yeah, so the first edition of that was actually my master's thesis at Union Theological Seminary. And I had already written my second published book by that point. And I hated the idea of writing a dissertation that nobody would read, and except for the 2 faculty assigned to it. So I really used that part of my dip school time to look at bringing my sexuality background into congregations and defining what would be a sexually healthy congregation. And that may sound odd to people. What that means, that's not a congregation that talks about sex every Sunday. It is a congregation committed to sexual safety so that there is no abuse, harassment, or misconduct. But it's more than that. It's a congregation where the pastor has the skills to both preach about these issues, and we'll talk about the Bible, I know, in a minute, where the pastor has the skills to do pastoral care, because so much of what we see has to do, whether it's, infertility, adoption, premarital counseling, working with a couple going through a divorce or separation, people coming out, people dealing with people coming out, people dealing with people transitioning, I mean, on and on and on. And yet we don't get any of that training in seminary. So having a pastor who has that training,
right.
Being a welcoming and inclusive congregation of people of all sexualities and gender expressions, and what does that really mean beyond hanging up a rainbow flag? You know, what do we have to do to fully include people? And so there are these eight criteria that go into that. And what I try to do is give people the skills to look at their own congregation to see how can they be better at this.
Do you find that churches generally have a problem or have difficulty approaching sexuality?
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you know that much of formal religion in America is erotophobic. People just prefer to ignore these issues until there's a problem. The churches across America have been roiled by allegations of sexual abuse and misconduct.
Right.
And people, part of the problem is that people didn't feel that they could talk about it, that they could tell anybody. A famous story that I remember reading about was in talking about sexuality in the Bible and how much it is that people avoid these issues. And so somebody once said, you know, I never understood why there were two animals in Noah's Ark. I guess I thought one might die. And so they needed a backup, right? So think about all the ways that even in teaching about the Bible, the basic Bible stories,
right.
We just ignore that part of it. And one of the things that amazed me when I went to seminary was, oh my God, there's sex all over the Bible. And it's not the sex of the religious right. It is not an anti-sexual ethic at all. But I don't want to ascribe their motives, right? What I understand is they are coming from a long purity tradition. There's some great books on how long. This goes way back to the Hellenization of Judaism. So Judaism, by and large, is a very sex-positive religion. Sex in traditional Judaism belongs in marriage, but it's a mitzvah. You're supposed to have sex on the Sabbath. There's only one day a year you're not supposed to have sex. That's on Yom Kippur, when you're supposed to be above your body. But otherwise than that, like, sex is always permissible. And then, so what happened in the early Catholic Church, you know, and then became the Christian Church, you know, Catholic meaning universal early church, was these councils, as they developed, began to legislate and control sexuality in a very major way. So the Council of Nicaea, which most Protestants know about because they say the Nicene Creed, not only decided that Jesus was human, which was a vote. I always remind my Unitarians that we were there, we lost the vote, but they decided that priests could get married at that time in 325, but that they couldn't marry dancing girls or Greeks. I don't know what they had about Greeks, but the idea was that you could be married, but you shouldn't be like too happily married. And, you know, and then by Chalcedon, you know, we've said, nope, priests have to be above sex. And so if you watch this, and one of the things I teach in my seminary classes is I always have my seminarians read The Confessions by St. Augustine, which is the first sexual autobiography ever written. You've read it, right? The whole first half is about his licentiousness. And he says in it, I love this line, Augustine writes, "Give me chastity, but not yet." And then, you know, he converts after his mother gets rid of his wife and his kid and et cetera. And then he creates Original Sin, right?
You're right.
And, you know, if you then watch the fold out, there is this desire to control people's sexuality, to control people's sexuality, to control women, to debase women, that was never there in the original. Jesus doesn't do any of that.
I think when Augustine came up with total depravity, original sin, and this idea of the human condition being so abhorrent, he was really just feeling more guilty about his own life than anything else.
A good therapist.
Yeah.
You know? And my experience in the 90s, when I was executive director of CECAS, I spent a lot of time on television. It was the era of the talk show. And I was often in green rooms with people from the right, who I was there promoting sex education, and they were there talking about what I was doing with Simple. And when I would have these individual conversations with mm-hmm. them, they always had these terrible stories about their sexuality. Mm-hmm. You know, there was always something personal that was broken, and which hurt me, right? You know, I had compassion for them. But I think that this whole movement backfires. For example, we know through evaluations of the purity programs for teenagers, the abstinence only until marriage programs, is not only don't those kids wait till marriage, so they don't work. 90% of American teenagers have sex before they turn 20 years old. The percentage of people who are virgins is not going down. And when they do have sex, they are less likely to use contraception.
Right.
More likely to put themselves at risk of STIs and pregnancy, and more likely to engage in anal sex than teenagers who had comprehensive education, because some of them decide, right. you know, well, they told me not to have what I call PVI, you know, vaginal intercourse, but maybe we could do these other things.
Right.
Right. Because nobody used those terms in my class. So, and not to say there's something wrong with anal sex a priori, but that teenagers don't have the skills to do it. If you don't have the skills to do it safely and correctly, you know, it's problematic. So, yeah. So these programs are not helping kids.
No, I don't think anything's designed. Yeah, I don't think anything's designed for actually teaching kids how to safely and appropriately have sex and enjoy it. It's just this thing that you won't. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or say no. You know, to teach honest, what is enthusiastic consent? I teach teenagers, that you want sex to be wonderful. And if you don't like kissing someone, stop there, because you're not going to like anything that comes after that either.
It just gets messy from there on out. Talk to me a little bit about some of your research into sexuality in the Bible. What did you discover as you started digging into the scriptures?
You actually don't have to go far. It's Genesis 1 and 2 actually set the whole thing up. I believed that the Bible taught, don't have sex, and if you do, it's for procreation, right? Like, that's what the general people think in the ethos. And it's not true. It's not true. So, Genesis 1, God creates man and woman at the same time mm-hmm. in God's image. And it's the thing that makes God most happy at the end of Genesis 1. And what's the first thing, I'll quiz you because you'll know the answer. What's the first thing God says to humans?
Be fruitful and multiply.
Be fruitful and multiply. Go have sex. The very first thing that God says, go have sex, right? And then in Genesis right. 2, which is, as you know, is an alternative story. It's not the next chapter. But in Genesis 2, God is unhappy for the first time. And do you remember why God's unhappy?
No, I don't.
Because Adam is alone, and God wants Adam to have a companion. And so God then does this thing that I always see in my business Saturday Night Live skit, where God brings every animal to Adam, every animal and says, what about the snail? Like, what do you think about the horse? Like, could the dolphin be your companion, right? This is my Saturday Night Live part. And Adam's like, no, God, right? Like, no. And Adam, the text says, gives him a name, gives them each a name, right? And then the text goes on and says, so then God creates Eve, and I don't like that rib part, but God creates Eve. And then the last lines of Genesis 2 are, and therefore a man and a woman shall leave their mother and father and cleave unto each other and become one flesh. They were naked and not ashamed. So here in the second book of the Bible, God is saying we need helpers, we need mm-hmm. lovers. Our sexuality is part of life. It is a gift that God has given us, that we should not be ashamed of this gift. And the second version never mentions procreation. There's nothing about go have babies in that second version. So I'm reading this as a sexologist back in 1996, you know, when I'm in div school and they say, you remember this, they say, read this like you're reading it for the first time, right? And so like, and I'm like, whoa. Like, this is not what those far right people have been telling you this says. There's nothing in there that says sex is only for procreation or be ashamed of your sexuality or control your sexuality. Yeah. And then, you know, as you read on through this dysfunctional family of the Genesis, right, which I've always thought it'd be a great movie, you know, like the four generations of that family because there's so much intrigue and, you know, deception and, a lot of sex, right? And with multiple people, none of those patriarchs, you know, with the exception of Isaac are, you know, they're not monogamous, right? They all have multiple people. And then as you follow, you know, as I kept reading in the Hebrew Bible, like this stuff is all over the place. So one of my favorite stories to counter the far right is the story of Jephthah's daughter in Judges. Mm. Jephthah is a warrior and he's praying to get himself home safely and makes this deal with God. I can't remember exactly why he makes the deal, but makes this deal with God, which is that he will kill the first thing that crosses his path as he's going home. And who crosses his path but his daughter? I don't know why it couldn't have been his cat, but, you know, like, so it's his daughter. And he says to her, I have to kill you. And she says, well, before you kill me, let me go to the woods or let me go to the mountains with my friends and we will mourn the fact that I never had sex.
Right.
And they go away and she comes back, which I also don't understand, like, why did she just like not keep going? But God knows what's happening on the hill,
right?
You know, with her friends. But she comes back and he kills her. And then the text says, and they have a festival every year to remember her because she had not known a man. So they actually mourn the fact that she never reached sexual maturity. So that's nothing like what they're teaching these kids in these purity programs, right?
Yeah. Oh, that just kind of sheds light on.
You all go look for Jephthah's daughter.
it's a good story. It's Pride Month, so what have you been able to find or conclude in your studies on homosexuality in the Bible?
So we have someplace between 4 and 7 clobber texts, is what theologians call them, which say basically. Men shouldn't have sex with men. There's one verse that says women shouldn't have sex with women. And what we know, and that's all there is these 4 verses. And I once did the math. It was like, and I'm going to be, not, I don't know whether I should be quoted, but it was like 0.00001 of the verses in scripture actually say anything about this. There are many more verses that say don't have sex with a woman who's menstruating. And yet the far right never talks about that, right? And there are, as you know, and as your listeners probably know, there are hundreds of times where we are told to love our neighbor as ourselves, right? So pulling out these clobber texts in the context of all of those verses, I think is wrong in and of itself. But what rarely gets talked about is that there are many forms of blessed relationship in the Bible. The stories of David and Jonathan, where their souls met, they're clearly soulmates. And it says that Jonathan, David's love for Jonathan surpasses his love of all women. And David, as your listeners may recall, had lots of wives. I mean, I think he had 28. I could be misremembering that, but lots and lots of wives. And so here is Jonathan, right? And so we don't know whether they actually, you know, I'm not saying that I know what Jonathan and David did together, but clearly a very central, important love relationship that the writers thought we needed to know about. We have the Ruth and Naomi story, which is hardly a typical story of a mother-in-law and a daughter. I actually like to refer to that as the first case of surrogacy. Naomi wants another child and, you know, she sends her daughter-in-law to trick Boaz into having sex with her, says she laid at his feet, but feet didn't mean feet, and has a baby for Naomi. And the tech, the Naomi and Ruth have that lovely passage that people read at heterosexual weddings all the time. Where you go, I will go. Where, you know, where you live, I will follow. Just so ironic, right? Think of people who are anti-LGBTQ people using that text because it's one woman talking to another. So we know that there were some of the prohibitions against same sexual gender loving behavior. First of all, there was no such thing as same gender loving behavior, but between sex, between the same people, I'm just too well trained to say it that way.
Right.
It was because of cultic prostitution, where there was same sex behaviors as part of cultic prostitution. And so much of the Hebrew Bible is a rejection of that. But more importantly to the Christians who are listening is Jesus says absolutely nothing,
right,
nothing about condemning people who are having same sexual behaviors. The lines that are, the very few lines there are in a Pauline letter that we don't even know Paul actually wrote. Jesus regularly brings in the most excluded, the most marginalized, the most vulnerable, including the eunuchs, who in my interpretation are probably the transgender people of the time, since he didn't have that language. And Jesus welcomes the eunuchs, blesses the eunuchs. And so, you know, what I want your listeners to know is that sexual and gender diversity is a blessing that God has given us. And I love and support everyone who makes responsible sexual decisions.
Yeah. And it's really about making responsible decisions and knowing what you're doing and going into it with all of the knowledge and power and just recognizing that we were wonderfully and beautifully made.
And it's not about, one of the things in my writing is that this is never about it. You cannot judge an act, whether an act is ethical. You can't say sex, this kind of sex, this particular act is right or wrong in its own context. You can only look at what the relationship is. Is it just? Is it consensual? Is it honest? Is it mutually pleasurable? Is it loving? And that ethic applies to everyone, whether you are straight or any place on the queer spectrum, whether you are married or whether you are single, whether you are 16 or you are 85, you know, there is a needs to be a single ethic based on the relationship,
right?
Not on, well, you know, is masturbation okay? Or is if part A goes in part B, is that okay? What we want to talk about, right? But people often say to me, Pastor Mike, how do these two careers match up? And what I say is that both of them are fundamentally about how we treat each other.
Yeah. I think that's the biggest thing I try to get across. And it comes down again to the greatest commandments. Love God with all of your being and love your neighbor as yourself. That's really the only things Jesus cared about.
But what else do we need to know? And I often point out to my congregation here in Reston, Virginia, that the part that people sometimes forget is as yourself. That this could have just said love your neighbor.
It does
love your neighbor as yourself. So self-compassion, self-care, it starts inside you in order to be able to love your neighbor. And the other piece of love your neighbor, which is totally apropos for Pride Month, is it doesn't say love some of your neighbors.
Right.
It says love your neighbor. So as a Unitarian Universalist, to me, that's without exception. That means everyone.
Even when it's hard.
When it's hard. Right.
I've been telling people, and as I've been trying to explain it more and more to people who are going through their deconstruction moment, it's if we can't learn to love ourselves, we can't love God and we can't love our neighbor. Because you have to, if you can't love yourself, it is impossible to love creation. So that's where we need to start.
Right. And the book of John says that, right?
Yeah, basically. What are some ways that you can think of that can bring about a more open and healthy discussion in our faith communities and in the community in general around sexuality and sexual justice?
So this kind of conversation, so thank you for having it. We need to be talking about this. We need to be educating children. I continue 20 years after I left my job at CECAS to believe that we need preschool through college and actually through life sexuality education. Our needs, even if you got it in the eighth grade, you don't have what you need at 35 or 45 or 75. So we need ongoing education and support. And we need to remember that just because we are uncomfortable with something doesn't mean it's wrong. Mm-hmm. We need to be open to finding information. I believe very strongly and will be devoting the next part of my career to educating future clergy and continuing to work with congregations and denominations on how can you be sexually healthy and help people. So the faith community has a definite role in this. But frankly, so does the government, so does the media, so does advertising. So, I mean, there's so many things. The good news, you know, I'm older than you are. The good news is on many of these issues, certainly on queer issues, we have come a long way since I started my work 40 years ago. We're still fighting about things like abortion, which, you know, I'm one of these women who I can't believe I did this at 18 and I'm advocating, you know, as a postmenopausal woman for the same thing. Mm-hmm. Like, that just seems crazy. But on some issues, on respect and consent and openness, and that there are laws protecting people's sexual rights,
yeah,
we have come farther, and we need to continue to educate and advocate.
And so then what's next for you?
I am working on a proposal now that I can't talk about, but I'm hoping we'll be moving along by the fall. I am actually leaving my position at the church after 5 years in order to devote my fourth professional act. So for anybody out there, you can be 65 and change your life again. Mm. I have missed working full-time on sexuality issues. And so while I still have energy and ability, I'm going to go back to doing that work. So I'm going to be developing some online classes. I'm teaching at a couple of seminaries coming up. And if anyone's listening, wants to bring a preacher or a speaker or a trainer, please get in touch with me. I'm at RevDeborahHaffner@gmail.com.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you. And this is Reverend Dr. Deborah Haffner. And I want to thank you very much for coming on Logic in the Bible and talking to my audience. And it has been a great pleasure to have you with us, and an honor also.
Thank you. Blessings to you and blessings to you folks out there.
Welcome to the wrap-up. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Haffner. The topic of sex, sexuality, and intimacy as it pertains to the Bible is discussed in a number of different ways, depending on what flavor of faith or religion you practice. It's important to keep in mind that regardless of where the discussion on this topic is had, what's more important is how the conversation is had. Pretending like human beings are not sexual creatures and suppressing an aspect of our very nature because it may make people feel uncomfortable because some might think it's inappropriate will only lead to more problems in our society. My hope is that this episode gives you a little bit of context, understanding, and of course logic behind some of what we read in the Hebrew and Christian scriptures. I encourage you to look up for yourself some of the things we discussed and see what jumps out at you. Leave a comment and let me know what came up for you in this episode. I would love to hear your questions or thoughts, anything that you may have or want to discuss. A small disclaimer, please remember to keep your comments kind and constructive. We're here to provide a safe space and facilitate an open dialogue for these discussions. It's all right if you don't agree with me or my guest, but let's have a safe space where we can engage in honest and open dialogue. So come to the table with courtesy and mutual respect for everyone who may be participating in the discussion. If you're listening on a podcast platform and you would like to leave a comment on YouTube, you are more than welcome and even encouraged to do so. Find us at youtube.com/@ Logic in the Bible. If you would like to find the podcast, like I promised, you can find Logic in the Bible on Spotify, and you can go to the main page and click on the Spotify symbol on the main channel page in the upper right-hand corner. If you don't want to use Spotify, you can search for it on Apple iTunes, Pandora, Google Podcasts, or really whatever podcast player you're comfortable using. I'm on all of them. Please feel free to connect with me at logicinthebible@gmail.com, or you can visit me on our website, where listening to the podcast online is also available. And you just find us at www.hellotosoulministry.wixsite.com/htsm. And also, our Facebook community is a place where you can leave comments or questions and engage with me and others in various discussions pertinent to our topic. I even encourage you to leave suggestions and ideas for topics you might like to have discussed on the show. All you have to do is go to facebook.com/, you guessed it, Logic in the Bible. Once again, thank you for joining me today and listening to Logic in the Bible. Don't forget to hit like, subscribe, and follow, and share this episode with all of your friends on social media. I'm Father Mike, and know that no matter who you are, where you come from, or what you've done, you are unconditionally loved. I'll see you next time.